Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, two Oscar nominees for Best Live Action Short, Red O'Caffey for On the Line and Steph Green for New Boy. Plus, director Beth Cravant discusses her new documentary, Heart of Stone, coming up next on Movie Geeks Unite. To the show, Movie Geeks United is on the air. Jamie here with you, and Jerry here with you too. Hey, buddy.
Hey, what's up?
Not bad. Good weekend for movies, financially at least.
Financially, it's a fantastic weekend. You couldn't ask for a better. This is, I think, the best President's Day weekend of all time.
Yes, and what better way to celebrate President's Day than with Friday the 13th?
With Jason Voorhees in your eye. Multiplex.
Yes. Which did phenomenally well.
Better than anyone thought. I mean, everyone knew it would be number one. I don't think anyone had any idea it would be this big.
Yeah, and we just, as our listeners know, we just completed a six-hour kind of series of shows for Friday the 13th and had a great response to those. So a lot of people have interest in those films, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And so we felt obliged to check it out ourselves, seeing that we've devoted so much time to it the past few weeks.
We devoted a lot of time to this whole series. I mean, more so than I ever thought in my whole life.
So, our thoughts. I saw it last night, obviously crowded theater.
Mm-hmm.
I was ready to have some fun.
Did you have fun?
You know, I said this to you earlier. I don't think you can make a kind of somber movie, horror movie, like a modern-day treatment, of films that work on a camp level.
Right.
And I think that was the case here. It just, other than that first opening sequence, I didn't find much exhilaration from it.
I agree with that. I think that everything up to the credits is great. Very interesting. A lot of fun. It harks back to that time. But then once we get to the credits, there is a tonal shift. And, you know, what might have worked for Rob Zombie and Halloween and some of these other remakes doesn't work here. But I need to point out something. On a lot of the reviews I've read, fan-related reviews and horror websites, it seems the film is not well received for the most part, but the one common thread I'm noticing is the actor who plays Jason and Jason's theatrics, if you will, are being very well received. And I didn't know what to make of that because he's very agile in this film, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And that's being praised. That's the one common thing. That's being praised. Jason's performance, if you will, is being praised. Otherwise, the film is not, you know, people, it seems like this film takes, like, a greatest hits from parts 1 through 4 in the old series.
Yeah. And it really does blow everything in the opening sequence. I mean, you basically get Friday the 13th, what you love about the series, if you love them, in the first 20 minutes.
Yes.
And then it's just, from there, it's kind of, it's so redundant in a series of movies that is already so redundant.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, from what I remember, I was never a diehard fan of these films, but I always remember, like, reading, like, I used to read weekly in elementary school, Famous Monsters of Filmland, and that's where I first heard of Friday the 13th, and this was in 1980. And I remember the pictures and everything in the magazine were very gory. And it was the first time I'd seen stuff like that. And I obviously knew this film was obviously very popular with my friends and their brothers and sisters who could go to the drive-in to see it.
Right.
And they would come back saying, oh, it's the greatest movie ever made. And you're watching. No, but they did. I mean, at the time, you got to remember, this is 1980.
I know.
I'm in fourth grade. I don't know any better. I'm looking forward to The Empire Strikes Back at this point. But I don't know any better. So I'm listening to everyone's, like, you know, older siblings talk about this film. But the gore in the first couple of films is the thing that always stuck out for me, because that was new for that time.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, and this one's a little lax in that department. And look, I never go to movies looking for that kind of stuff. So, but people that go see Friday the 13th are.
Mm-hmm.
It felt a little restrained almost for. It's oddly enough.
You know, that's a very good point. You know, I was thinking that, especially through the second half of the film, watching. And I was thinking that, you know, for a film that is emphasizing a lot of things, old school things, the gore, you notice as soon as the kill happens, it cuts to something else.
Yeah. Our first guest is actually on the line.
Okay.
So let's get to our first guest of the evening. He's been nominated for an Academy Award this year for his film On the Line, and the film has already picked up the Student Academy Award and over 50 additional international awards. It's a great film. It is a pleasure to welcome to the show the director and the writer of On the Line, Mr. Reto Caffey.
Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Mr. Caffey. Did I pronounce your name correctly, or did I massacre it like I normally do?
No, well, you know, I'm pretty used that my name is unspeakable in English, so you did well.
Okay. Welcome to the show. You're here with myself and my co-host, Jerry.
Yes.
Yeah, welcome.
Welcome.
Hello, Jerry. Hi.
Nice to meet you.
You were born in Switzerland, correct?
That's right. Yes, that's right.
When did movies first enter your life?
I think when I saw Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I remember, you know. I mean, there was this shopping center, you know. I mean, we don't really. I mean, now we do have malls, but at the time there was like this one mall that my parents would go shopping, and there was this children kind of place where you, and they had a little cinema, and this is where I saw the first films, actually. It must have been like 4 or 5. So but I started to make movies when I was about 11 or 12. Another friend who's actually the son of the owner of the department store where we shot this film now, he as the owner of the department store had one of the first video cameras with huge videotapes, like these VHS tapes, and we were reshooting a version of Indiana Jones back on the river where I live in February. I ended up in the river, so I started pretty early, actually. So.
Yeah, and those two titles that you mentioned, Snow White and the Indiana Jones films, I mean, obviously those kinds of movies transport you.
Mm-hmm.
Was that what drew you to them?
What do you transport? What do you mean by
well,
that?
They're kind of help me out, Jerry.
They're universal. They're the films that we read about. When people, those early Disney films speak to, I think, all of us.
Yeah.
They do really speak to all of us. So it doesn't matter what age we see them at, but there is something very escapist about them.
Yeah,
and they're
escapism.
Like, wow, I've never seen that before.
Yeah, I think, I mean, movies in general are kind of escapist, you know, because we want to go there, we want to see something interesting, maybe forget for a moment. I mean, stories in general are like that, you know. It doesn't matter if it's literature or a film, but I think if a story manages to fully capture you, you know, that's actually also my goal. You know, that's,
mm-hmm.
I just want to, in a way, grab the people emotionally, you know, and if a movie manages that, and I think the early Disney movies, they all do, and I mean, the new Hollywood films, and I mean, Steven Spielberg, you know, I obviously grew up with this very entertaining side of films, and I mean, now I do like much smaller scale films, and I wouldn't be the right director for a big action thing, but I still kind of like the entertainment side, even if it's a drama, you know. I think you have to just don't bore people, basically.
Yeah.
I agree.
So, but you studied, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you studied English literature and journalism in school?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, and you, a lot of your experiences early on were in the kind of journalistic field.
Yeah, that's exactly it, yes. Because I kind of ended up working because I needed to work, and I was working as a film journalist, actually. So this was pretty interesting, but after a certain while, I just kind of felt that I'm on the wrong side of the fence. And I was always making short films, but at a certain point, you know, there came a moment when I realized, you know, I don't want to be talking all the time about films, but I want to continue making them. So I ended up signing up for this postgraduate program in Cologne, Germany, which actually took 2 years. So that was a good thing, because if it would have been any longer, I wouldn't have managed to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about On the Line. First of all, if you can tell our audience a little bit about what the story is here with On the Line.
Well, I mean, to sum it up very briefly, you can say it's an impossible love story, and it's about basically a very good guy, a good man who makes a wrong, fatally wrong decision, and he suffers from that wrong decision. I mean, it's you want me to tell a little bit more, I think.
No, that's whatever you'd like to tell.
Okay, yeah, no, so that the people have an idea what it's more about precisely. This department store security guy, and he's in love with a woman who's working in the store, so he's watching her via the monitor system of the store, you know, during the day or at night. He waits for her to leave so that he can kind of end up by accident, coincidentally, on the same train ride. But he doesn't really manage to get to know her because he's kind of a shy guy. And mm-hmm. he's kind of a sweet guy who's in love, but actually he's this big guy, you know, this strong guy. So anyway, at one point he sees her entering the train with another man, and he mistakes this other man for her boyfriend, which turns out later in the story that it's the brother of the woman, but he doesn't know at this certain moment. He thinks it's the boyfriend, he's jealous, he's watching them. And so at one point he also sees how these two people have a fight, the woman and the man, and she gets out, and later on he witnesses how this guy gets into a fight with kids, and this is actually the moment where he could actually help him, which he then decides not to do. He decides to get out of the train, and basically he leaves him in this fight, which has very tragic, fatal consequences later for him. So basically the movie tells the story about their impossible relationship and how a story that could have been nice gets tormented by feelings of guilt.
Yeah, that works on his conscience. Throughout the remainder, when you put pen to paper and you started to write this, what inspired it? What were you after?
Well, you know, I mean, I was difficult to say. I mean, I did something like that myself, but I thought it would be interesting to have a love story that is like in a Greek tragedy. You know, have this impossible concept of if he tells the truth, he's going to lose the woman. If he tells her what he did or what actually he didn't, he would lose this love. And if he doesn't tell her, he cannot be with her because he's just so much ripped apart by feelings of guilt. So this I kind of like this impossible situation, and we just then try to find something that's not very black and whitish, you know, but something that is in the moral gray area. So we were kind of looking for a very specific guilt situation where there's no right and wrong answer. I mean, this is why we choose this subway fight, because, I mean, if he would have run over her kid with a car and taken off, he would be clearly guilty. But just, you know, in a subway fight, you not to help your seeming rival and you get out, well, you know, it's difficult to answer that, you know. What was the right thing? Maybe, and the viewer maybe watches it, and maybe the viewer thinks, well, what would I have done, you know? Because we have in Europe, we have a lot of stories like that. We have a lot of public aggression, and there are stories of 10 people watching a train, how somebody gets beaten up, and nobody would do something like that. So you can actually very directly involve the spectator with a situation like that.
Yeah. What was it about? What is it about short film, the short film form that draws you to it?
Well, because I don't have money for a long film.
All right, you're honest.
Hey, that's as valid a reason as any other.
Yeah.
No. I mean, there's a truth in that, of course. I mean, you build up experience with short film. You train in a way. I mean, I've made many shorts, so. I really like the format as well, of course, but I mean, I would be lying if I wouldn't say that I'm not interested in making feature films, because in a way, the problem with short film is that you cannot survive on that. I mean, there's no money in it. So basically, I also have to pay my bills, and so I want to work as a director. So of course, in the long run, the feature film is the goal, and it's also the next project is also going to be a longer project. But the short film in itself has, I mean, for this story, it has certain advantages, I think, because this film is 30 minutes, and I think it allowed me, in a way, to do something that in a feature film wouldn't have been possible. I mean, it's very open. I mean, the ending is left actually to the spectator to decide how the story will go on. And I kind of like that because the movie asks much more questions than it answers questions. So in a feature film, you know, I think the audience after 90 minutes, they are just, you know, conditioned for a bigger resolution. And in this format, I was actually able to just really leave certain things open, which I think now is an advantage of the film, because some people told me that the film stuck in their minds and they would think about it when they left the cinema, and they wouldn't leave them alone. They were thinking about the story. If you explain everything to the viewer, every single detail, I think you lose that effect sometimes a little bit.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I agree.
Tell me about making a short film. Yeah, obviously, you've made many of them, as you've said. Was there something that was particularly challenging about this one as opposed to the others?
There were two things. I mean, actually, because it's 30 minutes, it was a big problem because it's actually too short to be long and too long to be short. So it's a strange middle format. But this middle format, I mean, when I was in school, you know, a lot of teacher stations, you know, they're requesting that. They're like, okay, why don't you make something in that area to prove that you're actually able to do something longer thereafter. But basically, it's very difficult to compress a story into these 30 minutes because, I mean, you want to be complex. You want to work the story on several layers, several subjects, maybe even several characters that you follow a little bit. And then you don't have the time for the feature. So actually, the writing of the script took like 8 months until we had a solution that we were all happy with. And the second thing that was actually when we were shooting the film, that was a difficult part was to cast the violent scene in the train, these kids, because they were 15-year-old kids, and I knew this scene is going to be extremely important because it's like the angle of the whole film, and if this moment doesn't work, the whole film will not work because it's unbelievable. So we were actually casting for a very, very long time. We were casting young actors from acting classes, and they were all like middle class, nice little boys, you know. I mean, just not what I was looking for. And they were just playing the scene, and had something very, very theatrical about it. So actually, in the end, a friend of mine gave me a tip about a therapeutic group of in Basel where they were treating violent kids who were actually really having problems with that. And I ended up going there with my DP, with my cameraman, and we were actually casting some of those kids and found one of them who's actually now playing in the scene, which turned out to be exactly the thing that the film needed, some authenticity. And I mean, the even nicer thing that happened after the shoot is that this guy, now he wants to become a stuntman. You know, he kind of found a new perspective in his own life with this project. So that's several really nice things that were connected there.
Yeah. And I know that you've played festivals all across the world, and this film has been recognized many, many times. What is the path for a short film? What is its future? How can it be distributed? Can you speak to that a little bit?
I mean, this is actually the first film that really gets very heavy distribution now. I mean, it will be on iTunes, and it's been in many festivals, and there's actually DVD that's being made now. I mean, well, the Oscar nomination helps, of course, with that, you know, because... But I also think in general, you know, the distribution now via the internet is pretty interesting because I'm not very fond of watching films on my computer screen, but still, especially for the short format, because there's no way to put it in the cinemas. I mean, the internet is kind of interesting platform to do that. Mm-hmm. But I can't really say, because this is all just starting now, and I don't really have so much experience. I just see that there's opportunities to get the film out into the public. But when you're talking about festivals, I mean, the only thing that I paid attention to was that I started with the bigger ones, and because this will help if you have like screenings in Clermont or at Toronto or at some bigger scale short film festivals, this will actually also help the film enter in other festivals later on.
Right, right. And where were you, what was your reaction when you first heard about the Oscar nomination?
Well, it's a mix of only good emotions, actually. I mean, I knew a little bit beforehand that the film was in the shortlist because you have to send them another copy, but I couldn't tell anyone. So we actually gathered on that day, a couple of people from the crew, we gathered in a house and we watched it online when the Academy reads out the nominations, and we were pretty shocked because they don't read out the short film nominations, the main categories, and then we actually checked on the internet. But so I wasn't alone, I was with some people, and of course when we saw that we got nominated, you know, it was, you know, the typical thing, people hugging each other and champagne bubbles being opened. It was, I mean, it's a very big honor actually to also be here in the States and to experience this whole thing. It's kind of amazing.
I would imagine so.
Oh,
are your nerves going? It's next week. I mean, it's seven days away.
Yeah, well, nervous is not yet. You know, I might get actually nervous. And I think definitely when I'm sitting there in the audience and then this envelope thing is happening, you know, then I'll be definitely super nervous. But at the moment, it's more like a nice, great feeling of anticipation. I can feel it getting closer. Some people of the crew are actually coming here now. So it's all kind of, I mean, we're staying very close to Kodak Theater in a hotel. We can kind of see the street is being blocked, you know, and there's going to be screening in 2 days. I mean, there's like, you know, it's just a very nice sensation of anticipation now.
Yeah. And for the actual event, you know, as a budding filmmaker, as someone that is inspired by so many of these filmmakers that will be there that evening, are you excited about meeting anyone in particular?
Well, it's funny because you're not the first to ask this question, and I think I'm the most excited to just be there with some of the crew, and my, you know, my girlfriend is coming. For me, it's more like a private event that I want to share with people, and of course, I mean, there's going to be all these stars, but for me, it's just a nicer, it's more important actually to experience it with the group that has helped me make this film. And I also think, I mean, you know, I'm going to be so nervous on that red carpet, I think I'm not going to realize anything that's going on, basically. And I was at the nominees launch, you know, and it's kind of like, you know, you see all these people, but it's not the right place actually to do some small talking, you know. And it's I mean, we were sitting on the table at the nominees lunch with Danny Boyle, which was really nice, and there was John Lasseter who made Toy Story, so that was a fantastic experience. But there you actually get an hour or two of sitting together on the table. Otherwise, I just think it's going to be a huge frenzy, I think. And so I'm just glad that I'm surrounded by people that I know, and that this is for me more important.
Yeah, yeah. And about the future, do you have kind of a dream project that you'd like to mount, and you hope that this kind of gets that going?
Well, no, I actually don't. I've just picked up development on the feature film I told you about before. I mean, we're developing this at the moment, which is going to take a long time. So I'm actually also pretty open to scripts. I mean, I sometimes don't like writing so much myself because it's very you know, a dreadful, long, you know, a painful, lonely process. So
yeah.
I'm also very interested in reading scripts, actually. And I mean, you know, I'm going parallel a little bit. I mean, and some people offered me scripts which I all read, and I'm developing my own. But I'm generally interested in you know, like the smaller scale, you know, in America, the independent films, you know, like Juno, or the film that Alexander Payne makes. I like him very much as a director and as a producer. I mean, it's these kind of very warm films about real people, and you always have a feeling of knowing these people and that the director likes their characters. And it's like very close to life, tragic comic stories that I'm interested in, and not some science fiction special effects kind of blockbuster.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we're with you on that.
We are, yeah. I think we've had our fill of that for one lifetime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sir, we wish you the best of luck, and we will be watching
we're
out
for
you on Sunday night.
Yeah, well, thank you. This is always going to be nice if you feel some, you know, strength in the back, kind of.
I appreciate your time very much, and we'll be rooting for you on Sunday. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for having me on the show. Thank you.
Anytime.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, bye.
Okay, that's Red O'Caffey. His film is On the Line, nominated for Best Live Action Short at this year's Oscars. And we'll be speaking to another nominee from that category a little bit later in the program. This is great. You know, we had an Oscar winner. Was it last year that we spoke to him?
Yes, last year we had an Oscar winner, yes.
Yes, and it was Best Animated Short.
It was for Peter and the Wolf, right? It was for
Peter
something.
And the Wolf, yeah. Yeah, and I remember watching it with friends, and when they announced the winner, I started jumping up and down, and I said, we're interviewing him in 3 days. We have an Oscar winner on the show. It was a great
feeling.
That's
who I was rooting for last year, so I mean.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, that's great. And speaking of animated films, you saw Coraline this week.
I saw Coraline today, and I wanted to see it last weekend, but obviously, you know, when you have a lot of painkillers and you had your knee opened up and everything, it's not the thing you want to sit in a theater immediately. But I was able to do that today, and it's in 3D, and this is the second film I've seen in 3D this year, obviously My Bloody Valentine being the first, and it's a neat film. The voices are, Dakota Fanning, Terry Hatcher, Ian McShane, Jennifer Saunders, Dawn French, it's directed by Henry Selick from Nightmare Before Christmas fame, and written, of course, by Neil Gaiman, and it's a really neat story. And I would actually strongly recommend it to anyone who just wants to see something new and different. Because it's speaking of Henry Selick and Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton, it does remind me at times of Beetlejuice, and I mean that in a good way. And it's a very charming story, and it's one of the better things I've seen this year, actually. So
check
it out.
It's mind-boggling the time that goes into. Because that's stop motion.
I can't imagine how the patience involved with that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these are real artists at work here that love what they do, because that's just, for a feature film composed of stop motion animation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Incredible. And the 3D, is that conducive to the 3D treatment?
Yeah. Oh, it's I don't know how these guys do it, but it's definitely there as it was. I mean, obviously for My Bloody Valentine, but more so here. Because there's a lot of stuff that definitely, a lot of the effects and everything that come right out at you, and it's certainly worth it, certainly.
Yeah. And it's been successful. I hear that it's very dark.
It is. My brother and his daughter just came home, and within the last hour, and, you know, we were wondering, my mom and I were wondering, well, should we wait for them? And then, like, her mother was like, no, she can't go see that. So, and I could see why the last half hour there are some stuff that, you know, that's questionable, whether a little kid would be receptive to that or would want to see that. Even me, Mr. I don't believe in the MPA, understands where that comes in, you know, where, you know, you want to have some parental guidance. So I could definitely, I've become very aware of that in the last couple of years.
Right.
That's
rated PG, though, right?
It is PG, and
it's just odd, because how do you market that? How do you express that in any way in the marketing of it and not scare families off necessarily?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was packed.
Yeah,
it was packed. Now this is the second weekend it's been out.
Well, because they see that it's an animated film,
right?
And they equate it with small children.
And there were actually, it's really funny, there were much younger kids than my niece there. And they are much more concerned about going out and getting more popcorn than anything else. They kept running out. And a lot of people kept going out and get snacks and everything during the movie.
Right.
But it's a smart thing, this 3D, because they showed trailers for this one, Monsters and Aliens and the Ice Age sequels. And it's a smart thing, you know, during these times. You want to get people into the theater. And obviously, like we were talking about earlier, the weekend grosses each weekend this year have been astronomical. You just want to get people out. They just want to get out and get away from the news and everything. So
yeah, and actually, the important thing is that the 3D works.
It does.
And it's worked in these two wildly different genres.
Exactly.
Yeah. So other 3D releases this year. I know we have Up.
We have Up. That's I'm really curious about, because I've never seen a Pixar film in 3D. So I'm very curious about that. But you have, like I said, Monsters and Alien and Ice Age 3. I think there's some others too further down the line, but it's a good way to it's a good way to fill seats. It's very smart.
Yeah. I'm wondering, in terms of major feature films, well, these are major feature films, but the live action feature films like a Transformers 2 or
You saw the trailer for Transformers 2 with Friday the 13th, Michael Bay. Let me ask you this. What were your thoughts about that? We liked it. Chris, if we were doing the thing in the studio, would have probably killed us, but about the first one. But what were your thoughts about the sequel? I mean, the trailer, at least.
It's fine. I mean, it's what amazes me about Michael Bay is how resourceful he is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this guy gets all the toys.
He gets to shoot
on the pyramids. he's like, no, you will not shoot on the pyramids.
No, we're shooting on the pyramids.
here's $40 million. Okay, blow them up, do whatever you'd like.
Do what you need to do, yeah.
Yeah. So he loves his toys. And that's what his movies, are about. So it fits that he's doing a movie about toys.
Yeah.
I really, you know, it's not something that I get hyped up or anxious about. Maybe if I were 10 or 12, I might have. I might. But as an adult, I'll watch it. I'm sure I'll enjoy it.
It was fun. I was never a big Transformers person growing up, but I thought the film, for a Michael Bay film especially, I was like, wow, this is actually very entertaining.
Yeah.
And that's all you can ask for from a film like that. I don't think there's anything more that you ask for from a film like that.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of trailers out there now, I think that the one that most people have been speaking about for the past week is the new Tarantino trailer.
Yeah, how did you know that? How did you know that? That's what we were watching the last couple of days at this house. How did you know? I mean, imagine that.
So it's Inglourious Basterds. It's the new Tarantino, his first quote unquote war film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not fair to judge a film based upon its trailer, but the trailer is a piece of the marketing, and as a piece of marketing, what did you think of the effectiveness of the trailer?
The first thing I think of is because Eli Roth is presented, right there up front. I was like, oh, my God, the people who hate Eli Roth must be having a field day right now. But, no, what did I think? I think it looks like I have yet to watch the original film. I have the special edition DVD. I haven't watched it yet, but I don't think it's a direct remake, and not that it really much matters. But I have a feeling that on August 21st, we're in for a wild ride.
I think it's going to be wild. And
wild is the key word.
I'm always taken by how, because you tend to write him, and our next guest is on the line, so I want to get to her, but
yes.
To finish this thought, you're always taken by how exhilarating his work is.
I mean,
he's an exhilarating filmmaker, and he makes you love movies again when you know.
I couldn't have said it better, Jamie.
Thank you.
You said the most important thing. He is about loving movies, and after each film that he makes, that's what you feel. You feel that. That comes back to you.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, on to our next guest. This is a great film that we're going to be spotlighting here. Heart of Stone is the moving story of an inner-city high school struggling to overcome tremendous tension and violence. This inspirational story reflects the important role that education plays in creating safer communities and breaking down the stigmas of racism in our country. Here's a little piece of the trailer to this film.
Last year, we got weapons into the school. You know, I can't really tell you how we got them up in there, but we got them up in there.
We had to apprehend a young man who was carrying a loaded Uzi on a string around his neck.
I'm a die of blood. I'm a bee of blood.
Officer was killed in front of Wickwick High School last year by one of the Bloods.
I don't want to get into what it takes to become a Crip. I don't even think that's why I'm down here to talk about that. I hope not.
Let's go, ladies and gentlemen. If you don't have to return to the building, let's move. Stone to the third floor.
If this is a school and this is what they're comfortable with, I certainly have my hands full.
It's a pleasure to welcome to the show the director of this important and inspirational documentary, Miss Beth Cravant. Beth, are you with us?
I am.
Hi, thank you so much for being with us tonight. You're on the air with Jamie and Jerry, your two movie geeks for the evening.
Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
No problem.
Our pleasure.
I enjoyed the film very, very much. Tell me a little bit about what drew you into filmmaking. When was that, and what were those movies that made that happen for you?
Well, I started filmmaking when I wanted to tell the story of my grandmother to my children because my grandmother was an influential person in my life and I didn't know how else to tell it, and I went to film school and said, this is how I want to tell it. So that led to another film, which led to another film.
And what which film school did you attend?
Well, I was actually practicing law at the time, and I went to New York Film Academy when it was at Tribeca Studios about 12 years ago.
Wow. And were there role models for you? Were there people whose work you looked at and said, those are the kinds of movies that I want to make?
Well, I mean, I've always loved David Lean. I don't know if I ever consciously would ever.
My language, big time. So
I think it's just the storytelling that's captivating, you know, in an emotional way that I love.
Right. And how did you happen upon the story of this particular school? This is a school in Newark, right?
Newark, New Jersey, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've always been interested in going back to my past and uncovering my roots. And so as part of that, I was, you know, discovering my grandfather's past. And then I decided to discover my father's past. And he went to Weequahic High School. And I went on a bus tour of Philip Roth's Newark. And so my father went to Philip Roth's High School, and so I figured, let me check this out. And it was really cool to see Newark in the eyes of Philip Roth, and Philip Roth was there, and he received a plaque to the house that he grew up in, commemorating it as a preserved historically in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And when he received the plaque, he said, "Newark is my Stockholm, and this plaque is my prize."
Wow.
So it was really kind of cool. And I brought my camera with me when I went on that tour. I don't know why I did, but I filmed the whole day. And, in fact, Mr. Roth contacted me and said he'd love some of that footage. And I made a quick little five-minute film of him and sent it to him. And I knew I had him on camera, and I knew that I could do something with it. And so like a year later, I saw that the alumni were raising funds for the students that go to the school today. And that hit me, because I'm always concerned with what's happening today and what's important, you know. Mm-hmm. Yes?
And the school has, I mean, it has such a kind of history. Obviously, you said that Philip Roth graduated there along with your father. But what happened to the school? When did this transition occur to the school, and it started to become the kind of challenged environment that it eventually became?
Well, after the 60s, and after the riots, when the quote unquote the white community fled to the suburbs, and then the tax basis dropped at the bottom, the schools in the inner cities went downhill, and there was no support. And then you had, you know, the advent of the 70s with huge drug influence, and then the breakdown of the families, and then you had the beginnings of, gang problems up until today. Now we have, it's like Afghanistan in the cities, and it's a difficult problem.
Yeah, and so this group of concerned citizens, and along with the new principal of the school, Ron Stone, determined to turn the school around.
It wasn't just concerned citizens. What's interesting is that they have a lot of very strong rooted alumni from Weequahic section of Newark. And part of that strong rootedness from that grew an alumni association. And this association became like a board, and it became a charitable organization, and they started running it as a charitable organization to help the kids who go to the school that they went to.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's really a very small aspect of all the alumni, but they've really taken such root that they're galvanizing more and more support from the thousands of alumni who are out there to donate money so that they can get college scholarships for the kids who go to Weequahic High School today, and to send them on other trips and to give them other perks, because these kids don't have the parental support and the parental extras, you know, the money to have a booster club or anything
right.
to that effect
yeah.
that all the
yeah.
suburban kids take for granted.
I'm wondering, you as a documentarian, when you approached them about making this project, were they at all apprehensive, or were they very welcoming from the beginning?
You're talking about the alumni?
I'm talking about everyone involved in the school and this effort.
Yeah. Well, I was very lucky because Ron Stone, the principal, was a visionary.
Mm-hmm.
And he really thought beyond the typical principal. He wanted to get his struggle and out there to the world. And he and I, you know, were just very comfortable with each other, and he let me from the start come into his world. He opened mm-hmm. up his world to me and walked me around the halls of Weequahic High School, introduced me to the staff, introduced me to the students, introduced me to the teachers. Anytime I felt I really needed to get further into the lives of the gang members, he coordinated it and was there with me and on this journey further and further into his reality. So Ron gave me access. He was an amazing, amazing person.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about him. What is it in him that has this kind of power to affect change in the school? What makes people so receptive to him?
Well, you know, Ron was brought up on the streets of Newark in the 60s. He was 6 foot, 3 inches frame. He had a scar that creases his left jaw from ear to chin. He had an imposing presence, and that definitely helped him to gain respect. As the leader of the Crips from Weequahic High School said, he had to have a heart of stone to gain respect. He
mm-hmm.
had to lay the law down, and then once you got respect from the kids, they got to, he could be a caring person to each and every individual kid in that school, and they loved him. His personal commitment to and concern for each student really... His intent was to help each student discover their own voice and potential.
Yeah. And you've shown this film at festivals all over. I know. I think you did play at Slam Dance earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me
yeah.
about the reaction from these festivals. And do you get a sense that this film reflects kind of a larger picture of the education system in our country?
Yes. It premiered at Slam Dance in January, and where it won the Audience Award.
Mm.
And it was a huge, obviously, success with the audience.
Right.
And I realized from the reaction of the audience members that the film had the ability to change people's perceptions on education in inner city today. Several people came to me and said that their perception of the kids in the inner city schools had changed. That one woman said that she felt that she would put all her energies in the charter schools and forget about the other kids. But now, after seeing this film, she realized that the so-called gang members also needed attention because they could be intelligent. Kids with potential that can make something of themselves, even though they were the quote-unquote bad kids. And if you can put your attention into these kids, then maybe they could come out of it and slowly change the whole perception of of other gang members coming up in the inner city.
Mm-hmm. What's really one of the really inspiring things about the film is its portrayal of a community kind of coming together to make the school better for the future, for the youth. And do you see a lot of that? Have you heard stories from this film of other communities doing the same thing? There doesn't seem to be, maybe I'm mistaken, that investment as much as there should be between community and education.
Now, I agree with you. I think that this film shows that it takes a village. It takes a strong leader. It takes the community. Whether it's the alumni or it's just businesses within the inner city that have a stake where they are, you know, law firms, insurance agencies, banks, those businesses that are down there, hospitals, and invested in the inner city, if they can raise funds and have and get together to help inner city kids, then, you know, maybe we can do something.
Mm-hmm. And you as a filmmaker, tell me a little bit about the process of putting together a documentary. Do you go in with a set of or a kind of agenda? And in the course of making this movie, were you surprised the direction it ended up taking? Because the documentary seems like, through the process, it's a living thing, obviously, and it will change from your
mm-hmm.
initial conception.
Yes. I go in with a very open mind. I interview a lot of people, and I let them talk to me, and I listen. Mm-hmm. And I see where they take me. And if they don't take me any place that's interesting or pertinent to, I feel, you know, like education in America, then I go somewhere else and I interview that person and I continue my search for a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was definitely a 2.5-year discovery to find a story, and Ron Stone led me through into the lives of three gang members and connected me with the alumni, and the alumni took me into their world, and it was a process.
Yeah. And is that what attracts you to the documentary form? I mean, that process, why do you feel it's important that documentaries are important, that they matter?
Well, I think what attracts me is definitely the process of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
To uncover a community in crisis that has no voice, that I can show, in this particular film, that I can say to people in the suburbs, turn around and look at Newark, New Jersey, which is 5 minutes from the suburbs. You know, it's really 5 minutes and you're there.
Yeah.
And look and see what's going on right at your doorstep. Don't shut your eyes to it, because once you're aware of it, then maybe you can understand it. And once you can understand it, you can empathize and you can give back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What's the future of the film? Do you have additional screenings coming up?
Yes. Actually, in 2 weeks, it will be at Cinequest Film Festival in San Jose, where it's already won the Kaiser Permanente Thrive Award, and that's an award that tells a story for thriving in the face of adversity.
Mm.
It will be. Yeah, thanks. It's really cool. And it will be showing Sunday, March 1st at 7:15, and then on Tuesday, March 3rd, and then on Thursday, March 5th, all in San Jose Cinequest. From there, it's going to the Philadelphia Film Festival, and it will be showing at IFC as part of the Audience Award from Slam Dance, waiting to hear from other film festivals, and hoping to get it out privately in an educational forum so that it could help galvanize other inner-city schools throughout the nation.
I think it's an important film, and I just thought it was wonderful, and I think it's very important that it be seen by as many people as possible. So anything that we can do to help you in that direction, by getting the word out, just let us know. Any additional screenings, just let us know, and we'll let our listeners out there know too. Are there upcoming projects or upcoming subjects that have taken your imagination that you want to explore?
At this point, I am babysitting my baby and trying to get it out there. So that's a full-time job.
Yeah,
in
I
this
bet.
Climate, it's huge.
I was curious, though. You said IFC. Are there any plans to show that on a lot of cable providers have IFC on demand, like what's currently on theaters or in film festivals? Do you know if that would be included?
I think the IFC showing is just like this one time in New York and L.A. through the Slam Dance, but I'm working on getting it onto a TV station and pursuing it, and I'll let you know.
Okay, great. No, that's wonderful.
Please do. And Beth, thank you so much for your time tonight, and please come back to us anytime in the future.
I will. Thank you so much for your concern. I greatly appreciate
it. Anytime.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, be well. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Okay, that's Beth Cravant. The film is Heart of Stone. It's a great one. If it comes to any festivals near you, and we'll keep you guys updated on the upcoming festivals, please check it out, and we'll let you know where the film's going from here. It's important. It's an important film, and I love, you and I talk ad nauseum about documentaries and their potential to invoke change. That's great.
We have a great guest that we had on a while ago, Rod Laurie's new film, Nothing But the Truth. There's an article in the Washington Post about that and several other films that are sort of in limbo right now because the studios or the people, the companies that are supposed to distribute them have gone belly up. But I haven't seen Nothing But the Truth, but I really want to see it, and I don't know when we're going to get to see it right now because the status of the film is in limbo, but it sucks that these smaller companies over the last couple of years have dissolved, and I really, I was thinking of our show yesterday, reading the story about Laurie's film, but I really want to see that movie, and I don't know. Have you seen it? Have you seen Nothing But the Truth?
I haven't seen it, no.
Okay. No, I didn't know if you had if you went to a screening or something, but I hope it doesn't get lost. I mean, I hope it does. I hope they can find a way to release it somehow.
Yeah, this is a time when a lot of these films, like Nothing But the Truth or like Heart of Stone, you hope that the as a culture, we can definitely be better by watching them and being exposed to them.
Right, absolutely, especially Heart of Stone, yeah.
Yeah, it's just a question of how to get it out there, and some passionate company out there that wants to spread this this great content.
Right.
And IFC is great for that, and I pull up Sundance and IFC stations all the time.
Right.
It gives me the pulse of what's out there that I can't get from anywhere else.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah,
and these festivals are wonderful too, and especially the ones that are so strongly tied to community, which any festival kind of worth its weight is.
That's true.
And these are perfect kinds of titles to play. Speaking of festivals, I got a festival, that Sarasota Festival, starting next month.
That's right. I tell you, dude, you get a lot of good films there. So do you know what the lineup is yet? Or?
No, I don't think they're announcing it until March 6th.
Uh-oh.
But they had the director, the executive director of the Cannes Film Festival, come to them last month, I think.
Really?
To advise them, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that's very uplifting. That's very positive. So.
Yeah. So who knows? Who knows what kinds of, and they're really trying to become a community staple and reach out to their community, and they're one of the top film festivals in North America, and they just over 200 films every year.
That's a lot.
Vast lineup, and what I love most about it are the documentaries. I get to, out of the 30 to 40 movies I see in a week there, probably 80% of them are documentaries, and I just love it.
You see a lot of good films, and the people that we brought on the show, I mean, it's always fascinating subject matter.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to see what catches on, because I'll be watching TV now, and I'll see the one that played there last year at the Death House door.
Mm-hmm.
That's been getting a lot of play and a lot of critical reaction the past year.
Right.
I saw this great documentary on the plane crash in the Andes.
You saw that one. I know the title's on the tip of my tongue, but I know exactly the one you're talking about.
And they based the film Alive on.
Right, Piers Paul Reed's book, yes.
These were all of the real survivors from that trauma, from that traumatic experience, and they are all reunited in that place. And they sat with their children, and they
mm-hmm.
told them stories about what that was like, about that will to survive, and all the kind of awful things that they had to do to preserve that. Life-changing, and you see that in their eyes. It's
mm-hmm.
a haunting documentary.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah. But you get those experiences from these film festivals, and that's why I think they're so important.
Oh, they are. And they're very important, as we know some of our friends from the show. I mean, the film festival circuit, within its own way, is sometimes the only way that these films are shown in theaters.
Right.
So, I mean, they're very important. I can't emphasize how important they are.
Yeah. We talked trailers a little earlier. There's another trailer out. It's for a remake.
Which film is it, please?
The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
You had to bring that up. Okay, I love the original. I don't know if it will work. I don't know. I don't know.
I think the only reason to remake it is because people of a certain age are the ones that go to the movies, and they don't
right.
remember the first one, you know? And
so you get interest in the old one, that they'll see this, and then, hey, we'll go rent the original.
Oh, I hope that's what happens,
yeah.
So I doubt it will. I doubt they'll even know that it's a remake when they walk into it.
Right.
But, you know, it's got Denzel, it's got Travolta, it's got Tony Scott, and as far as I know, he's toning down all the kind of editorial pyrotechnics he usually puts in all of his movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
that kind of film. I mean, it's just not that kind of film that requires that. So
yeah, and you wouldn't think Man on Fire would be that kind of film either, but he does it.
He does it, but I actually think Man on Fire, outside of True Romance, may be one of my favorite Tony Scott films.
Yeah.
I really think that's an incredible film, and obviously when he and Denzel work together, it's a good time.
He makes good films, but
yeah,
I'm saying he really makes films for the ADD generation.
Yeah. You're right.
So,
you're absolutely right.
Do you really need the subtitles on an English language movie?
No.
It's very. He's a very stylistic director. So he's made his own style outside of his brother Ridley.
Mm-hmm. He's been the more commercial, the more if you really want to think about it, the more successful of the two as far as box office goes.
Yeah. So the reason to remake this movie is just it's a good. It's a good yarn.
There's
nothing that I don't see that speaks to any relevance to today, and it's just a commercial venture to bring it to a new audience, I guess.
It's interesting that you bring that up after talking about Tarantino, because Tarantino for Reservoir Dogs was obviously very influenced by the original one with the name.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
it's a very interesting connection that you've made for the show.
Well, thank you. It was completely accidental.
But that was always the thing. You know, a lot of people, and I'll defend Quentin Tarantino as I will defend a lot of people on the show, but I work with a gentleman who's a good friend of mine, but I worked with a gentleman a long time ago who took Tarantino to task for ripping off that film, and I was like, well, he's not ripping off, he's paying homage.
Yeah.
And this is his way, Reservoir Dogs is his way of paying homage to a great many films, like City on Fire, The Killing, and The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, among others.
Yeah, and obviously that original film, the director apparently is still living, Joseph Sargent.
And what does he think of, has anyone, that's what I want to know, with some of these things, I'm always curious if the original director or the original writer thinks.
Yeah.
We know what
yeah.
John Cunningham thinks of the remake of Friday the 13th and Last House on the Left. His name is on them, so we know that.
Well, we know he thinks he's going to get some good residuals this
yes,
weekend
exactly.
from the grosses. but the other cast members, I think there's maybe Hector Elizondo is still with us. The other cast members have sadly passed, the major
yes,
cast members. Robert Shaw, who's played in this one by Denzel Washington, and Walter Matthau. I mean, great.
Walter Matthau's just great. Can't say enough about him.
And that last shot, I don't know if you recall the last shot of the movie. It's when a woman he's talking to in the apartment gives one last piece of discriminating. And that double look he does, and then it just ends. It just ends on that on Matthau's just priceless.
It is. It is. It's wonderful. I don't know if you'll be able to recapture that, but I'm very curious about it. When they first announced, I was like, okay, how are they going to do this? You know.
Yeah.
I'm very curious.
Yeah, Matthau was just exceptional.
All right. Well, while we're on this thing of remakes, let me ask you about another remake that I just mentioned.
Okay.
With Sean Cunningham. What do you think so far of the trailer for Last House on the Left?
Yeah.
You knew I was going to ask it at some point on the air, so let's just get it out of the way.
Well, it fits that. I mean, it fits the mold of where that genre is going now. Just the down and dirty brutality. Because this movie was kind of an anomaly back then.
Yes, it was.
Because it predates all these new generation horror films, and it really is just brutal.
It is very brutal.
It's one of the least entertaining, most effective movies I've seen of any genre.
Okay.
That's a combination for you. I mean, it's not an entertaining movie, but it's totally effective.
All right, I think it's a very effective trailer. Now, let me ask you this. Do you think one of the criticisms from a lot of our friends who run the horror podcast on this network is that the trailer gives away everything? Do you think the trailer has, in fact, given away everything?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, but the common person isn't going to complain about that because they want to see the movie before they buy a ticket.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, no. No, I was just curious, because it does seem like I was watching the trailer, obviously, before Friday the 13th the other day, and it's just like the more I think about it, I'm like, you know, you almost want to say you write a letter to the producer. You guys have given away the whole entire movie in these two minutes.
It's not like it used to be. I mean, the original was made for a dime, you know, and this one obviously has a lot more money behind it.
It does.
It has an opportunity to really capitalize on the popularity of this genre. So they need to give away as much as they can to get people in the seats.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, I don't know how to feel about it. I don't think it can be effective as that original, I hate to say.
No, I agree with that.
At the same time, I think it might be a better movie. It could very well be a better movie.
There is definitely some truth.
In the next week or so, we'll be welcoming on one of the stars of that film, Garrett Dillahunt. He's going to return to the show, and he plays the lead baddie in that film.
And he's a very good actor. We interviewed him for the Assassination of Jesse James a year and a half ago, and this guy is incredible. He's a great interview, and I look forward to talking to him again.
Yeah, he's a great talent. And he also had No Country for Old Men that same season. That was a great season for him. So that's just one of the films that we'll be spotlighting in the next week or so. We'll also be bringing you some cast members from The Watchmen next week as well, we should be. Our Empire of the Sun tribute, our ongoing Steven Spielberg tribute, we've got that ready to roll as well, and we'll be tackling our first film out of our Greatest Films of the 70s series.
McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
That's right, and we're getting emails in right and left. I'll have to tell you about that a little bit later.
Okay.
Confirming to participate in that show. Let's get to our third and final guest for the evening. This is a great film. Up for a live-action short Oscar this year, writer-director Steph Green's moving film New Boy captures the experience of being the new kid in school through the eyes of Joseph, a 9-year-old African boy. The film has already garnered 10 awards, including the Best Narrative Short at the Tribeca Film Festival, and the Crystal Bear special mention at the Berlin International Film Festival. It is a great pleasure to welcome writer-director Steph Green to Movie Geeks United. Miss Green, are you with us?
I am, Jamie. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
I can hear you great. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Now you're from excuse me, you're from Ireland, correct?
Well, you can hear from my accent. I was actually born in the States. I was born in San Francisco, but I have Irish heritage, and I've ended up living in Ireland for quite a few years now, and yeah, have Irish background. So
yeah.
Yes, Irish and Irish American is how they've been calling me.
So, but you have family still in Ireland, like you said.
I do. Yeah, indeed.
What's the film culture like there?
It is. I mean, it's obviously smaller. There's been these amazing successes that have come out of Ireland, starting, you know, some way back from Jim Sheridan, mm-hmm. My Left Foot, and then recently
mm-hmm.
Once, you know, that
yeah.
wonderful movie.
Oh, that's a great film.
And so I think that it's a smaller community. A lot we all know each other, which is a lot of the fun. And it's right now it's thriving, and there's a lot of inspiration because there's so much recognition happening of the work that's happening out of Ireland.
Yeah.
So it's an exciting place to be working right now. Absolutely.
Were there films that you saw as a child that drew you into the world of filmmaking and wanting to pursue it?
You know, I honestly just watch. I think I watched television all the time. I mean, you know, my parents would not like me saying that. I did not watch too much television, but I loved the television. I wanted to climb in, and I think that it, more than anything, may have fueled initially the interest in film.
Yeah,
definitely.
Did you study at any school, or what path did you take to get into filming?
I didn't go to a kind of conservatory program where you're just studying film. I went to a basically liberal arts education, but I focused on film. And then
mm-hmm.
I did my master's degree in film theory in Dublin at University College Dublin. And that's really where I started working in Ireland. And I have to say that it mostly was just continuing to always be working on something, you know, always
yeah.
having this side project, trying to be shooting something all the time.
And what is it about, excuse me, what is it about working in the short film format that attracts you?
Well, I mean, you know, the simple answer is it's how you start. It's less of everything. It's less money. It's less locations. It's often less characters. And
mm-hmm.
so it's a good starting place to figuring out what kind of stories you want to tell. So you try to sort of form a calling card and get your sort of tonal qualities figured out as a director. But generally, in terms of, I've come to really love short films and to see them as this art form in themselves that is underappreciated.
Yeah.
In that they're like the poem, you know, they're the short version, they're the novella, they're the short story, and they have their own quality, which I really enjoy. And I've now been able to see so many from traveling with New Boy. I've seen so many incredible shorts all over the world that, you know, I wish it was a more mainstream activity, going and seeing shorts.
Yeah, me too. This film, New Boy, is fantastic.
Thank you so much.
This is based on a short story by Roddy Doyle. How did you find it, and what about it spoke to you?
I read New Boy, the short story, which has the same title, by Roddy Doyle, in the Metro Éireann, which is a multicultural newspaper in Ireland. And then it is also published in the McSweeney's short story collection that comes out here, well as a new compilation of short stories Roddy just released called The Deportees, which really focuses on the new multicultural Ireland. And I immediately felt it would make a good film, and I was lucky. I kind of quickly found out how I could get to Roddy, wrote him a probably extremely, you know, gushing letter about how I thought his story was so great, and he was generous.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful.
The material, though, how did it strike you? How did you relate to it?
I think I related to the new person phenomenon of just that Roddy writes these incredible characters that you feel so much empathy for and relate to so much, even if they're quite different. You know, I never immigrated from Africa to Ireland. I came from the U.S. to Ireland
right.
as an outsider, and And I feel like, I just felt like everyone must have these same feelings of newness at some point in their life. And I liked the way it dealt with multiculturalism from a child, from a 9-year-old perspective. And sort of the intelligence of how the story was told.
He does that very well just in Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha.
Mm.
I mean, he does, that's wonderful. I love that book. It's a wonderful novel.
Yeah. That's a great book.
And your work with children in this is extraordinary. You have great kids in your cast. But had you already had previous experience working with children, so you felt like this was a task you could handle?
I never had worked with children so intensely. Yes, I had done some sort of other short films and commercials where I had been working with kids. I joke that I can make eye contact with them because I'm very short, so I'm not intimidated by their stature. But I really do love working with children. I want to continue working with children, but also sort of have new projects that aren't with children, because I think I don't want to be pigeonholed as sort of the child director. But these are spectacular actors. Children have this imagination that is, you know, they're sort of more advanced than a lot of adult actors, I think, in their ability to pretend. With a sort of emotion, with this emotional truth already being there.
Yeah, and
a kid
they're
really
so
at play is a good actor, you know.
Yeah, they're so open. And I'm wondering about I'm sure there was an audition process, and particularly with the young actor that you have playing the lead, so-called lead in the film, Joseph. How did you find him, and what were you looking for, and how did you bring it out in an audition?
Well, we were looking for a kid who could communicate with his face and gestures as opposed to language, because I think Joseph has something like 3 lines, and what, you know, a couple of them are one-word lines. So he just doesn't say very much, and we needed to still feel it was his story and feel his perspective. So to be honest, the search was so difficult. We had to keep pushing our shoot date because we just weren't finding the right boy, and so much was going to rest on him. So we extended our search. We started in Dublin. The search extended to other cities in Ireland, and then it extended even farther out to the UK. And finally, we found Otunji Ibn Cole, the main little boy, through Lou Clowder, who's a casting agent in London, who had seen him, who knew of him because he opens the film, the Bond film Casino Royale. He runs with these 2 little Coke bottles. Sort of a mafia, African mafia scene. So he was brought to our attention, and then very quickly I just sort of played the bully and he played Joseph, and very quickly we could see this sort of anguish on his face at being new, and this sort of sincere thoughtfulness that it just was who he was as a person. So he was right. He was immediately cast. It was like within a day we knew we had the right person. And he's going to be my date to the Oscars.
Oh, cool. Wonderful.
That's great. That is great. Tell me about that, the Oscars. Obviously, it's a week away. It's inching up. First of all, how did you find out about it? What was that experience like for you?
Well, I was unlike, the movie stars that say, oh, I was asleep and my agent called me. I was checking avidly.
Right.
Because we sort of, it was a faraway dream idea, but we, of course, had some all fingers and toes crossed that it could possibly happen. And my mother saw the announcement online before me, and she rang me and said, I don't know if I'm looking at the right thing, but if I am, she was just so excited. And I think she's very excited that she's the one that told me. And then it rippled across Ireland, and I feel like, word traveled quickly, and it was very, very exciting.
Oh, it's gotta be. How are you feeling now? Are you feeling relaxed, or are you feeling a little bit nervous about the impending night?
Well, I'll tell you, what we're doing right now. I mean, well, I feel grateful and that this is happening, because I'm learning, we are the shorts being honored is quite amazing. Just like we were just talking about, people really don't go see shorts, and it's not a mainstream. It's not a mainstream art form, and yet it's being honored at this incredibly mainstream event. Yeah. So John Bloom is this sort of governor at the Academy that I think he just pushes for these short films to be recognized and seen. And he works with this company, Shorts International, who are really taking care of us right now and showing the film in theaters all across the state. So it's just been very exciting, and we feel so gratified that they are recognizing short films at all,
yeah.
you know, in this setting. But in terms of what we're like doing in terms of pragmatics right now, are we're arranging the accommodation for the Irish entourage that is coming in to celebrate with us, which includes the little boy, both of the teachers in the film, the you know other sort of production help and crew who just all want to party with us. And
yeah.
so right now, you know, we're off to go make sure that the hotels we've booked them into are suitable. So it's really about I just want everyone to really enjoy this. You make a film with hundreds of people, so it doesn't feel right to just celebrate its success on your own.
Yeah, it's a majorly collaborative art form, obviously, and everyone's just got to be so excited to be part of it. I mean, this is a great little film. Did you attend the luncheon, the Oscar luncheon?
I did, yeah. That was a trip. It was so
That must have been surreal.
Yes, we, I think the most surreal moment was seeing all the press, the paparazzi and the photos clicking away. And, you know, I think we were in back of Amy Adams and in front of Kate Winslet or something. And so, you know, Tamara, thank you, the producer, and Steph Green, and like all the cameras had been going. And then it was like, click, click, and we were moved along. But we didn't feel, we did not feel slighted in the least. It was really fun.
Oh, it's got to be a great honor, yeah. So what do you hope this brings for you? Do you have future plans or a project that you'd love to get going, a dream project perhaps?
I think, yeah, the fun thing is that it makes you a little braver about trying to get that meeting or talk to that dream actor person that you imagine as that key role in the film
yeah.
you're working on. So it's the opportunity that I feel grateful and excited about. And yeah, I have ideas, you know, that I've been trying to talk about for a long time now, and maybe there'll be some different kinds of listening now, movie ideas, both in Ireland and in the States, and some books
yeah.
I'd really like to option. And so yeah, you know, you're trying to always, you are always working on something, and now I just feel like, you know, hopefully there'll be more opportunity for me to share it and get it made.
Yeah. Well, you are a fantastic talent, and I love New Boy. And actually, people in the chat room during this live show here, they're cheering you on, too. They're excited.
Oh, thank you.
We're all cheering for you.
So, Steph, thank you so much. And in the future, please give us a call. Any upcoming projects, we'd love to welcome you back on.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Steph. We'll
okay,
see you at the Oscars next week.
Okay. Bye, Jamie.
Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's Steph Green. The film is New Boy. It's really good. And actually, you can catch it online. It's online. I'll get that address
okay,
for you.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I wanted to close the show with a friend of ours, friend of the show.
A friend of ours, a good friend of ours, someone we look up to.
It sounds like something from Donnie Brasco.
Yeah.
He made a film a couple of years ago. It's called Killing Christian. It is now available for purchase on DVD. It's a double whammy because you get a feature-length documentary on the making of it included in the package, and it's a great documentary. I'm fascinated by that kind of process anyway.
Right.
So we're awaiting his call. If he calls in, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, if you call in, Jason.
Yes. So any frequent listener of the show knows Jason O'Brien. So that was great. We've spoken to two more Oscar nominees tonight.
Yes, it's awesome. It's wonderful. And they must say, you can definitely feel they're very excited, very nervous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool. Very cool.
And it is great how the Academy has stayed with honoring the short film format.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's wonderful because it's the only way that these films really get a huge audience. So
yeah.
More power to them. It's one of the few things I actually think they do right, and I'm very happy for that.
Yeah, that's true. Jason O'Brien is on the phone with us. Jason?
Yes?
Yes, hello, Jason.
We have Jason O'Brien on the line.
Yes. So I'm on the Oscar show with a film that has no chance of being nominated for an Oscar. You know.
You said that, not us.
Oh, okay.
Well, you're the Oscar guy. You have your own show
well,
called
yeah.
Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, you're the...
That is
you
true.
Know, you could have
I know everything
to stalk Sid Gannis, so, I mean, you know...
Yes.
First of all, what do we hear about the Oscar ceremony? There's little tidbits coming up every day about what to expect, and they all kind of pique your interest. And it's a big
question. Well, you heard that
mark.
Peter Gabriel dropped out from
mm-hmm.
performing.
Good for him.
It looks, I completely agree with him because they want to try to put the songs into like a 90-second little snips of it, you know. And,
right.
And I could say... You know, and that's a great song from Wally. I mean, so
it is, yeah.
And you know what? I think those are the only "quote unquote" performances that need to be in the Oscar telecast. The
yeah.
ones that are nominated.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you need to hear the scores, and you need to hear the best nominees for song.
Yeah, I mean,
there
I
only
really
three
like the years. Yeah, there's only three. I mean, it's and they could even you know they could combine the two from Slumdog Millionaire into one. Performance, you know, but
right.
at least let, you know, Peter Gabriel. I mean, would they have done this to Bruce, you know, I wonder if he had been nominated? I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the question, though. If Peter Gabriel believed he had a shot of winning, would mm-hmm. he have taken the stand?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I still think he has a shot at winning. Especially since Bruce isn't nominated, it's kind of a, you know, it's a hard one to predict, actually. I could see it going, you know, to anyone except maybe the lesser known one from Slumdog Millionaire.
Mm, right.
But you know, I think it has a shot. I mean but I don't know. I mean I don't know if that's maybe factoring in if he thinks that, you know, because Slumdog is such a favorite this year that you know, that it may just sweep that as well. I don't know.
Yeah. Interview with Hugh Jackman earlier in the week, he talked about the new kind of intimacy of the ceremony.
Yeah. Well I've been talking about this, you know, last week on my show I was talking about I don't know why I got this idea that I think they're going to make it a dinner. They're going to make it like a tables and stuff. And I don't know why I'm thinking that, but I just they keep talking about they're going to take big risks this year, you know, and that
could
you know,
be
and
anything.
I keep thinking what could they do maybe to really kind of shake it up a bit. And so I'm thinking that maybe they'll do that. I don't know. I haven't read anything or even heard anything remotely to this, but if I'm right, I had quite a scoop.
There you go.
You were there first.
I was there first, that's right, because no one else has even, I haven't heard any speculation that talked about maybe doing that. You know, but I mean, if you think about it, I mean, the Oscars started as dinners. I mean, they, you know, in
that's
the 40s
true.
and 50s, they were, you know, dinner events, you know, so I don't know. Maybe they could do that.
And the special way that they're going to announce winners this year, that's been alluded to as well. I just hope they don't do what they did that one year. And give their acceptance speech from their seats, you know, for the so-called lesser important categories. That's so humiliating.
Yeah, I don't think they'll do that. I mean, the fact that these are industry people, you know, that producing the show, you know, I think everybody kind of learned from that experience. I don't think we're going to see that again. But
I think
they're doing.
We would hope.
Oh, yeah, we would hope. I mean, it sounds like they keep. The only thing I've heard is that the way that they present the Oscars are going to tell a story. So I'm intrigued by this idea. I don't know exactly how that's going to occur, but. I don't know
they,
how
they
it's
say they say that what's going to tell a story?
The way that they present the Oscars, like each category, each presentation or something is going to tell a story or something. It's going to be related in some way. So that's the only thing they keep teasing about it, and I can't make out what they could maybe be thinking about that.
Well, I think in keeping with the craze of reality TV, each nominee should be in their own dunk tank. And whoever wins can escape the dunk tank.
Now, that's a good idea right there.
I think they need to make it like a game show, like the Oscars, like an Oscars game show.
The Oscars game show, exactly.
There you go. One of them.
Yeah. Or pick the winner at random in a special case. An audience member picks a case.
Yes. There you go. That's
winner.
A good idea.
I think I'm full of ideas. Speaking of...
You're full of something, but...
Speaking of Oscar winners and Oscar nominees, obviously Slumdog is going to win big. I think that's everyone's guess this year.
And that's the way it's looking, certainly.
Well, that's the way it's looking, but there's always that surprise.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's already one winner from Slumdog, and that's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. See, I'm tying in the game show Oscar thing here.
You are.
You really
worked overtime here for this.
Yeah, they're actually thinking resurrecting that show because of the popularity of Slumdog.
Mm-hmm.
And they may. Especially if it does go on to win Best Picture, you know, more people are going to, you know, the people that have been waiting to see, okay, is this, you know, really worth seeing, will finally go see it. And, you know.
Well,
and
they're going to see that as opposed to the other Oscar nominees. They're not going to see The Reader or Frost Nixon. They're going
no
to see Slumdog.
If only Frost Nixon were in 3D, I think that would have been. I'm not a crook, and the fingers poke you in the eye. I think that would be.
Yeah, that
be
would have been a unique experience, I must say. Yeah.
So I'm just waiting for the Celebrity Billionaire where they bring on Dev Patel, because you know that's going to happen. That would be great TV. That would be great.
It would, you're right.
Yes.
Okay, I can't give a proper segue between the Oscars and Killing Christian.
I won't even try.
I was waiting to see if you'd come up with something really spectacular to segue.
Yeah. So a few years ago, I think we're talking 2004?
Yeah, that was the year we filmed it.
Okay. You mounted this, your independent film project, yeah, and called Killing Christian.
Yes.
It's now available on DVD.
Yeah.
Is it through Amazon where you can purchase it?
Yeah, the killingchristian.com is the website for it, and it has the direct link. But you can get it on Amazon or createspace.com, either place.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the background of how you came up with the idea and why you wanted to make Killing Christian.
Well, it actually was it wasn't written by me, so it was written by two friends of mine. And that was like in the winter of 2003, and they actually gave it to me just to kind of read and look over and kind of give some feedback to them. Because at the time, they had a producer already lined up that was interested in producing it, and a possible director attached as well. So I was really just on a consulting basis to, you know, really kind of give them some ideas and pointers, and I did that. And then that producer deal fell through with the producer kind of had ideas to put the production through that they didn't really agree with. And, you know, and they felt like since so much work had been put together already, you know, securing locations around the city of Birmingham and that kind of thing, that they wanted to keep it going. So Laura Mullins, who was one of the screenwriters, a real close friend of mine, asked me, you know, she knew I wanted to direct, and I'd done some directing in college, but I'd never done a feature on my own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she asked me to direct, and that's kind of how I came on board. And then, you know, we kind of just went full scale ahead. Like, I came on board in April of 94, and we were already shooting by June. So, you know, we had a really quick schedule to go on, especially once we started casting, because we had some actors that were going to be moving later that summer. So, we just kind of got ramped up really quickly with it.
Yeah. And so, but this was a long process in terms of even when you finished shooting, there were financial difficulties with just getting through the editing of the thing.
Well, we did everything the wrong way. I mean, we basically, you know, made commitments to a production crew, you know, that said, you know, we were working on getting our money. You know, we basically had one guy that was in charge of the finances, and because we were moving so fast with the film, you know, we kind of put all our trust into him, you know, because none of us like to deal with money and all of that crap. You know, so we figured, okay, he's gonna get our financing, and, you know, he said that the production crew, you know, they agreed that we could split up the payments amongst the summer. And so they basically started filming with us basically on faith, you know, that we'd get that first payment to them, you know. So, you know, we're already like, I don't know what it was, like 7 days into filming. And, you know, that's when we hit the first realization, when we got the news that the investor money was not coming. You know, and the production crew basically said they'd have to quit and go work on, you know, other paying gigs. Now, if you can imagine what a feeling that must have been like, you know, to be 7 days into filming, you know, and now you may lose the production crew and, you know, lose the whole thing. You know, that was probably the lowest point of the production. I mean, it got worse after filming, but to be actually in the middle of filming, you know, and then, you know, have to face that roadblock, you know, and how are we going to come up with, because we owed them like $10,000 at that point, you know, and basically finding out that, you know, the investor money is not going to come. So we were going to have to try to put up with this, put this up ourselves if we were going to continue.
But all this is makes for a great, entertaining making of documentary.
Yes, it does.
All this heartache.
Of course.
And turmoil. Yes. Yeah.
That's right.
And I actually watched the documentary before I watched the film. And I mean, it gave me a special added kind of insight. I could see the process as I was watching the film and know how much he has labored.
Right.
So I'm going to give you my review on a personal level, just between us.
Okay.
But
yeah.
To say to our audience, I mean, your film is well worth seeing, especially when it's packaged with this documentary, because it is an accomplished film, and you obviously know film language, and you have some very good people in it, in the particularly the actress I wrote to you about.
Oh my!
Yeah. Jamie found a particular fondness for one particular actor. You know.
Yeah, and I want to work with her on a film in the future too.
Is this like a future like stalking victim that we're witnessing here?
Yeah, possibly.
Okay.
I should probably get warning to her. You know.
I think you better do that right now.
Just don't tell her the kind of film I'd like to make with.
Oh my God!
So it's well worth seeing, and it gives you great insight into the filmmaking experience, coupled with that documentary as well. So killingchristian.com is the website.
Yeah, and the documentary actually is in the final. It actually should be just maybe, hopefully this week, that it'll be ready on Amazon.com, and so you'll be able to purchase the documentary.
Yeah, yeah. What was the document? Why the documentary? Because well, they're shooting footage during the filming of it, so there was always a planned documentary.
Well, what it was is when we were actually in the middle, or before filming, we had searched. We were, you know, putting out information that we needed technical crew and that kind of thing, and we went to a local college, their film club, and we, you know, to basically try to meet, you know, cinematographers and that kind of thing, people that might want to get a chance on a feature film. And I had mentioned in there that we were looking for someone to just maybe, I mean, this is a first film for a lot of us, so, you know, I felt like if we had some behind-the-scenes coverage of it, you know, it'd be cool to just have, you know, footage of, you know, this behind-the-scenes process. Mm-hmm. So we met two students there, and they actually thought it would be fascinating to make a documentary just on the, not just the making of kind of a film, but, you know, really kind of cover the difficulties of trying to make an independent film in Birmingham.
Yeah.
You know, and I really liked the way that their thinking and, you know, how they wanted to make this a film of its own, not just a behind the scenes for like the DVD. And, you know, so they followed us, you know, through a lot of the production, even afterward, you know, to cover, you know, the difficulty that we had after filming, you know, trying to raise the money for post and that kind of thing. So
that's something I want to ask you about, Jason. I've been meaning to ask you, what is the independent film scene like in Birmingham? Is there like a group of ragtag filmmakers that you have there?
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, when I moved here, there wasn't a lot going on here as far as film was, you know, related. And, you know, a lot of people that knew me, I was in my 20s, you know, and they were asking me, why did I choose to move here instead of moving out to California? You know, and there was a lot, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff with that. But, I mean, you know, what I found once I got here is that there was this kind of community that was really trying to do a lot of film productions. And then when they got the film festival here, I think it really started to blow up even more.
Right.
You know, so it is a really good community. There's a lot of people. The trouble is there's not a lot of money to put into. You know, a lot of people are doing short films and that kind of thing. But a lot of, like, the production crew that I used for this film, you know, they're having to do commercials and that kind of thing because it's really the only thing paying right now.
Right.
So there's definitely a lot of talented people. That's one of the things when I came on board to direct this that, you know, I realized, I was like, wow, there's really a lot of really talented people here, you know,
yeah.
And it's just there's not enough money to support feature-length films.
Mm-hmm.
What is
true,
the take of the city? I mean, are they very supportive of cultural affairs?
Well, they're not really. I mean, they've struggled for years with getting, you know, the film commissions here in the state and the city, you know, but I mean, the fact that like a film like Sweet Home Alabama is filmed in Georgia, you know, kind of tells you that, you know, that they don't really work that hard to try to get feature productions here.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so
well, whatever.
There's not a lot of support to be had.
Yeah, I mean, there were, and that has a lot to do with, I'm sure, tax breaks and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The film commission. Whatever
right.
that film was, it was from years ago, and it was actually the name of a town and a state, and they shot it in California, and it was something in the southeast.
Yeah.
I mean, I know from my point of view, Lakeland, I mean, it sounds like a podunk place between Tampa and Orlando in Florida, But we're very like culturally diverse. We've had an art school here forever and community theaters and things. But they just started trying to mount, I love that word, their own kind of film commission, film group, which is headed by someone that knows absolutely nothing about film. I tried to tell them about the show, and they don't know what the heck I'm talking about. And they don't know the first thing about what direction to go in. So it's all about people and resources, too, finding the right people. And that's why I think that you'd be perfect for the job.
You guys have this great, like, great relationship, this online. And
we're like oil and water.
It's
the odd couple.
So killingchristian.com is the website, and it's a great entertaining time. I seriously recommend everyone going out there and purching it from our listener
base. So you
really
did like the film?
I did. I liked I did.
You're not
I
just saying that, you know,
film.
To be nice or anything?
No. I like the film. You know what happens with me, Jason, is I get I get so many films in, and obviously you're a close friend. I consider you a really good friend. I get so many films in, and many of them don't necessarily work, and I have to put on a nice face, and I'll admit that to our listeners out there for some of these films. So when I say that I liked your film, I did enjoy it. It's not just because you're a friend. I think it is accomplished. I think you had limitations, and you're working with limitations, and those are detailed in the documentary. But for those limitations, you came out with a finished film that feels like a finished film, and that's
And one of the things that I think really helps it too is the fact that filming in a place like Birmingham, you know, because it's not really well known for film, you get a lot of production value. Because if you notice, like the locations that we got, you know, we got all those for free except for one, you know, and like a couple of the scenes that you see, like in the middle of downtown Birmingham, you know, we were able to just go out on a parking deck in the middle of the night, you know, with no film permits or anything, and just set up equipment and film. You know, and we only had one incident where the cops pulled up and asked what we were doing. We said, oh, we're filming a movie. And they're like, okay. You know, you can't do that stuff in L.A. or New York, you know, in the middle of downtown.
No, you can't.
You know, you get a great-looking shot like that.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that helps a great deal that, you know, not only we had a good, you know, it gives you a lot of good production value, but I think the crew that we had, too, was just a really accomplished crew, and they were able to make it look really, really good, too.
Yeah. And all of this begs the question, what did you think of the new Friday the 13th?
No. That was really on the tip of my tongue, Jason. I mean,
you actually think I went to go see that?
Mr. Oscar, come on. So, okay, you have you have a show upcoming on Thursday night of which I'm playing a part, I imagine.
The Oscar, our Oscar, final Oscar predictions.
A five-member panel, 3-hour Oscar prediction show.
Oscar-palooza, yes.
Yeah, that's good. That's very good. Don't give anything away, but have your thoughts, have your predictions shifted over the past few weeks?
Some of them have. I mean, there's some in some major categories that I think have shifted since, you know, we made the predictions on your show. You know, so, yeah, I mean, some have stayed the same, but for the most part, I think some of these have changed. And that's kind of the nature of the beast with Oscar season, you know, it kind of, you kind of have all these front runners when the nominations are announced, and then, you know, in those weeks that go by, you know, it starts to shift and change. And
right.
Have you heard the rumor that, you know, some people are saying that Heath Ledger is not a lock now anymore?
Dude, I wouldn't want to be in the studio if that goes down wrong.
And no kidding.
I mean, that...
Oh, well, how would you like to be the actor that goes up to try to accept if Heath Ledger doesn't win?
Oh, my God, Josh Brolin might not... Forget W the later years.
This is just it, man. I was reviewing the... Chris and I were arguing, because I don't think Slumdog deserves Best Picture, and I'm a party pooper, I know. Chris and I were arguing about the merits of that. I love Slumdog.
What's nominated? I'm curious, Jamie. What's nominated? What do you? Well, I guess you can't say because you don't want to spoil Jason.
Well, I've already told you, and I've already told our listeners.
Oh, I know what Jamie would want to win.
Yeah, I think the most persuasive argument that matches mine is something that Mark Harris wrote in Entertainment Weekly about Slumdog and Wendy and Lucy compared to each other. It was one of the best movie pieces.
I read that.
I love that piece. Anyway, so we were reviewing So a third friend was tired of hearing Chris and I argue. I just like to argue and get Chris all riled up. I wasn't even making an argument that I necessarily believed in. But he said, okay, I'm tired of hearing you guys argue. Let me go through the past nominees and the winners of Best Picture. And it is amazing how often I think they get it wrong.
Well, that's true, and I think that way too, actually. I mean, it's actually rare that they get it wrong. Actually rare that the Best Picture choice is actually the one that I chose as the year's best film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, I'm trying to think back the last time that would have happened. American Beauty, I probably agreed with. That was my number one. You know, so you're talking 99.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to think of the recent years. I don't think I had any of the others as my number one film. They were in the top five, but...
But they were reviewing movies, and obviously the most astounding decade for movies for me were the 70s, so they were reviewing those movies. Mm-hmm. Something like 76, you have the year that Rocky won. The mm-hmm. other films in the category include All the President's Men, Taxi Driver.
Taxi Driver, yeah.
And I believe Network, was it Network?
Yeah, Network, yep.
Mm-hmm. And Bound for Glory. Those are the nominees that year. And I'm thinking, what a crime that it wasn't Taxi Driver or All the President's Men.
Taxi Driver at its time was reviled.
That's true.
I mean, so doesn't surprise me.
I don't care.
I know what you're saying.
Even at 3 years old, I wouldn't have reviled it.
Great. We might not be doing this show. Jamie would be in jail.
Yeah. You know what it is about the Oscars? I mean, that's kind of the interesting part. I mean, that it captures such a moment in time because you try to think of what, you know, the voters were doing at the time. You know, they don't always foresee good, you know, the films that are really going to stand the test of time. I mean, you only have to go back to 1941. They picked How Green Was My Valley
mm-hmm.
as the
right.
picture over Citizen Kane.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, they don't always – it's always about the mood of the, you know, kind of the world and the country at that time.
But at the time, actually, you know, if I may, I would have probably been – I remember Citizen Kane was not a – well, it was a critical success, but not a mm-hmm. popular box office. So you could see where, given the time that happened,
sure.
you could see – now, in hindsight, we're like, oh, my God, how could they? But if you take actually the circumstances –
But I remember reading that people, whenever they were allowed to, did want to see this movie, did want to see Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the question of RKO and their handling of the release under pressure
right.
that
right.
didn't really allow for a mass audience to find it.
Let me ask you this, Jamie. Of what's nominated, what do you think should win?
Out of what's nominated?
What do you think should win?
Jason, do you want to answer that for me?
Jamie would say The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
It's between that and Slumdog are the two that I like the most of what's nominated, so I can see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like The Curious Case. I argue with Chris. Chris says The Curious Case, not good.
He has the same feelings for it as he has for Transformers and The Simpsons movie, from what I remember. So, I mean...
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it. 3 hours of talking to you, it'll just be a blast.
there was such enthusiasm. I mean,
yeah, wasn't it though? He's so thrilled.
Yeah.
I mean,
So I'm going, and I've never had my tonsils taken out before, and I think this will run a close second. Yeah.
Oh,
so I'm looking forward to stepping into the dentist chair with you Thursday night.
And we actually have a female on the panel for the first time.
Turning on the Kenny G. Yeah, we have a female on the panel, and you trusted her with me. That'll be great.
Yeah, what's going to be interesting is if we can make it through 3 hours and Jamie does not hit on her once. That's going to be the question.
Well, I think if you get past the five-minute mark, you're home free. But
well, that's true.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, man. It's going to happen the opening of the show. All right, I'm looking forward to it. So no show tomorrow night for you because you're saving it for Thursday?
Yes, there's a show tomorrow night. What are you kidding me?
But what now? Let me ask you this, because you're doing the show. What is tomorrow night's show going to focus on?
Well, tomorrow we got just, you know, covering all the latest stuff. I mean, some of the stuff we've talked about tonight, you know, that little things that have been talked about with the ceremony and,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing. So
now you have a show tomorrow night. You have a three-hour show Thursday night. Is there such a thing as too much Jason O'Brien? Are you sick of
him? Hell no.
Hell no. Are you kidding me? You know, I may add another show on Wednesday. Just, I mean, this is our week, man. This is Oscar week, man. I mean, you know.
This is Jason's big week.
Yeah.
So, okay.
I mean, this is what I created the show for. I mean, I got to be on the air now.
I want to close off with this. What are your plans? What is your kind of regimen like on Sunday? What are you doing? Are you having a party? What's going on?
No, I never do a party because what will end up happening is I'll end up inviting some people that don't take it quite as seriously as I do.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'll just piss me off.
And you'll just have to throw them out of the house.
Yeah,
but do you have a get-together? Do you have more than just you and your wife there?
No, that's pretty much it. There are some people, like there's enough people around here that do take it seriously.
He has our phone numbers blocked.
Yeah. No, I actually do not answer the phone. I actually will, if people want to try to get a hold of me, they're going to have to try to email me or something while I'm online. But, pretty much it's, just watching everything that day and getting ready and,
So you're going to watch the pre-show?
Oh, yeah.
All the arrivals?
Yeah, I love all that stuff, man.
I'm watching it with Kristen Scott Thomas. All right, never mind, but...
Okay, well, I don't know that we'll have a show next Sunday, but...
we got to have a show. All right, never mind. I'm going to go get drunk in a bar then somewhere.
You guys should do a show where you watch in the arrivals and make your own comments. That'd be fun.
Are you sure you want that?
Like I said, I'm watching it with Kristen Scott Thomas. Now I got to make that happen.
Now you got a week to make that happen.
I know. Forget it. It's not going to work.
And I actually watched the Barbara Walters special, too, so...
Oh, is that on that night, too?
Yeah.
Of course. That's an Oscar tradition, man.
Yeah, I mean...
She's got Hugh Jackman and... who else is on the show?
I don't know.
Mickey Rourke.
Oh,
she's got Mickey Rourke. I saw Mickey Rourke on Charlie Rose the other night.
Yes, I heard about that.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard that him and Sean Penn are making... they each want the other to win.
Right.
So... This is a tough category, man.
It is, yeah. It's going to be one of the two of them.
Before Thursday.
Who knows? Maybe Adrian Brody will pick it up. I don't know.
He was good at Cadillac Records, but not that good. I mean,
that'll be a shocker. I mean, everybody would be shocked by that.
I mean, how did he get
it? Yeah, we need a write-in vote to win one of these years. That'll be fun.
Yeah, it would be terrifically exciting if there were a tie.
That would be, yes.
And they'd have to fight for it in character. So
they actually both will win, but that hasn't happened.
You'd see Harvey. You'd see Harvey Milk fighting the wrestler, Mickey Rourke.
Yes.
Okay, on that note, maybe we should close out the show.
Yes.
All right. Well, Jason, the film is called Killing Christian, and it'll be available soon.
It's available now. The documentary.
I thought you said you're still, man.
You're still working on the documentary.
No, I'm just waiting on the Amazon.com to get it. It takes a while to get listed there for some reason, and it should be done this week. So.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. Thank you, Jason, for calling in and being a good sport.
Well, hey, I'll be still or anytime.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.